Welcome to the Dr. Future Show. Welcome, everyone. Beautiful Tuesday here in Santa Cruz. Welcome, Agent Nada.
Well, hello, Dr. Future.
She's at the last day at the old control console here before the new one shows up in the studio.
I'm very, very excited.
Yeah,
I like it.
Going digital. The classic analog controls are going digital.
Yeah. And the cardboard, actually, I like it because you can see how it's gonna go.
It's so flexible.
The cardboard is a giant piece of cardboard cut out in the shape of the new console, taking up the other half of the room here. And it sort of gives us an idea of what we're looking forward to. So it looks kind of cool. Meanwhile,
it's easy to imagine.
Yeah, very easy to imagine. So I'm kind of excited about it.
Billy seems really excited, too.
Well, I think he likes that this old desk is going to be gone, and there's going to be so much room for dancing in here.
We're going to be able to have a rave in here.
That's right. Apparently, this studio used to be used for parties back in the 40s and 50s.
Right, and how have parties evolved?
Yeah, you could have a whole live band in here.
Yeah, and dancing.
Exactly. And what's Santa Cruz known for?
Exuberance.
Yeah, exactly. It's our job to keep the... The fun element high in the radio talk show business.
And weird.
And weird. Yes. Exactly.
We're good at that.
So what weird stuff do we have today, do you think?
We have a lot of really great stories that I think you always put together the best stuff. I'd like to talk about crowdsourcing.
Oh, yeah.
That it's a concept for some people.
Could I just invite our audience, if you are anywhere near your computer, to go and check out our website, drfutureshow.com/links, and then you can see all of the amazing headlines that we are going to explore in the next hour.
Yeah, and also you can go to ksco.com/drfuture and get to go along with the Sinocast.
Yeah, I'm going to put up the radiation story now.
So we're going to talk about the radiation, the open source. So, Dr. Future, for our dear audience, open source, what does that mean? Or not open source, excuse me, crowdsourcing.
Crowdsourcing. That means where we get information from lots of people simultaneously.
Which can be from open source places, such as people that allow their programming to be seen.
Yeah.
Open source in that way. And this is crowdsourcing where you... put out a question to people on the internet and give them ability to capture data in some way.
And send you information.
And send, either could be a vote, like what they use on the, what are those? I don't watch TV, but the talent search program. Where
Dancing with the Stars.
Dancing with the Stars. And we have one right now where there's a Santa Cruz young man that's on it right now.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, cool.
Oh, my gosh. Anyways, we'll maybe someone tell us what the name
of it is. That's crowdsourcing. What is she thinking of? American?
So that's crowdsourcing.
Yeah.
Idol!
Hey!
Yay! I remembered. So, yeah, there's a really sweet little Santa Cruz young man on. He's a... I can't remember his name right now, but...
Yeah. Well, crowdsourcing. Okay, the way I like to think of it is kind of like human-based search.
Instead
of just going
search.
To Google or Bing, you ask your audience, and people call in.
Right.
Yeah, that's one. That's the simplest form of crowd. Another way is that people Twitter information. In the case that of the Japanese radiation monitoring, it's a little bit more sophisticated. Now, this was a...
Because you're capturing data as far as radioactive levels.
Yeah, and exactly. And one of the things that the Japanese government has done is kind of clamp down on information about the Japanese radiation situation.
Yeah, they've been pretty tight on the information all along.
Yeah, I have a video report on our links page where it has an American expert living in Japan who is very knowledgeable about what's going on with the four reactors. And it doesn't look good. It looks pretty nasty.
Yeah.
And they're all leaking like crazy. And and so what some people have done, one particular group has done, is created a crowdsourced initiative to deploy Geiger counters all over Japan.
And this is the name of the company is called Safecast.
Right.
And aren't they're out of port? No. Where are they out of?
Yeah.
Is it Seattle or Portland?
Yeah.
They're out of Portland.
And they got financing through Kickstarter.
Kickstarter. So this is something I want to come back to, Dr. Future. Kickstarter is a very interesting
very.
Online website where people are
getting projects funded.
That's right.
Yeah, you go to Kickstarter. If you have an interesting idea and you want to get it funded, you go to Kickstarter. You might be able to raise the money to do that.
Right. So these guys went to Kickstarter. They talked about how they were wanting to get more information about the radioactive levels in Japan.
They're trying to raise $33,000 to send over 100 Geiger counters.
Between 100 and 600 Geiger counters.
Right.
And then the people, is it like a, there's an iPhone app or a Droid app or?
Well, you'd go to safecast.org, which would aggregate the radiation readings from the government, the nonprofit, and from individuals with Geiger counters, as well as into another service called Pashub, which is a global open source network, the P-A-C-H-U-B-E. And it's a global network of sensors.
Now, I think this is really interesting because I remember one time we talked about Intel futurist. Mm-hmm. And the big takeaway I got from his little video is that the future is going to have a lot of sensors,
right?
A lot of devices. Some of the devices could be dust. And these devices are going to capture information. They're going to capture data, and they're going to send it back to a bank that's going to tally it up and give us information.
This fits the model of thinking of the Internet as a nervous system for the species. And what's the nervous system do but collect information about what's going on?
So that it knows how to best react.
Yeah.
And so this is a similar thing, this crowdsourcing mm-hmm. project. Safecast is people going and carrying their own little Geiger recording devices mm-hmm. and sending their information into a website that then can be transmitted, broadcast to everyone else who wants to know if they're in Japan, where do you not want to go?
Exactly. And it's a brainchild of Marcelino Alvarez from Portland, Oregon. And he has a company called Uncorked Studios, and he has a blog where he's been writing about this. This is up on our website if you'd like to know more about it. And he went from concept to launch in 72 hours, from a paranoia over the radiation mentality and lack of available information to figuring out a way of asking for money to create a plan to collect information that he was concerned
that
about.
That can then be transmitted to the rest of us. This is the beauty of the Internet, is that our democratization of information, and that people can get what's happening straight on in real time.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of ties in with, you know, the other aspect is that's looking out into the world, like the radiation aspects of health that affect us all. While we're on the health topic, there was also a very interesting app that came out this week for diagnosing stroke using the iPhone.
Oh, that's the app that I was mixing up with this app. I was thinking there was an app with this, although they could probably, you know, make an app.
It's from the University of Calgary, faculty up in Alberta.
And so this can tell you if you've had a stroke.
Yeah, you can make a stroke diagnosis with the same accuracy as using a full-blown medical computer workstation.
Is it free, Dr. Future?
Well,
I think I could splurge for this for my mom and dad. Yeah. I mean, this would be a really handy app.
Well, that's a good question. Janata, I think it's initially being used specifically in the medical profession. But I think it's only a matter of time before this type of technology will be available for the rest of us.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
That is really, truly an amazing story.
Yeah. It allows for advanced visualization, and they say it's between 94 and 100% accurate in terms of diagnosing for acute stroke.
It's just incredible where these smartphone applications are going. It's mind-blowing.
Yeah. Well, the computer in your pocket with your smartphone is more powerful than your desktops just a few years ago. And even more powerful in the sense that they're more networked and they're more connected. They have situational awareness. They have cameras. They have other types of sensors, accelerometers. They can even monitor your heart rate and soon blood pressure, all just with your phone. So it's not just a phone anymore. Phone is just an app for this portable device that you're carrying around with you. And from all indications show that the smartphones are the most rapidly evolving segment of the cell phone market.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah.
You know, so interesting, interesting stuff. And so that'll probably be available for the Android as well before long. But right now, the iPad or the iPhone app is the one for strokes.
So, Dr. Future, just another thought that came to me about how to explain crowdsourcing. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of in the early 1800s, in the 1820s, when we finally laid cable all the way around the world and that we could send out using the Morse code, send out information that was happening all the way around the world. There was also, at the same time, this boom in love for meteorology. And people in the British Empire, all over the world, there was colonies at a lot of places at that time, mm-hmm. they really got interested in monitoring the temperature. And so it was like this campaign where people would monitor the temperature of wherever they were and then send it to the university in London.
It would aggregate it all?
That would aggregate. And that was when we first started learning about the Earth's temperatures
and global weather patterns.
And global weather patterns, exactly.
Yeah. Interesting. I think the first transcontinental cable actually started in the 1850s.
Oh, I think it finished before then.
Yeah, and the 1850s. Right. But yes, I think probably by the 1920s it was pretty sophisticated.
No, 1820s. I'm saying 1820s. 1828 it was already all the way around. That was when Krakatoa blew. That Krakatoa, the volcano blew, and everybody knew because the cable had been.
Okay, I thought the telegraph was in the 1830s, but I could be
Let
wrong.
Let me see.
Thank God we have the Uber brain at our fingertips here to check this out.
Wikipedia.
Yeah. But it keeps getting cheaper. One of the other stories we have this week is the Raspberry Pi computer. It's a computer on a stick. Only $25. Full-blown Linux computer the size of a USB stick. British nonprofit has been looking at passing this out as the cheap computer to give to the masses all over the planet. It looks like a leftover scrap from an electronics recycling center, but it definitely works, and it's an ARM processor, the kind of processor you have in your cell phone, combined with an HDMI interface and a USB interface, so that you can plug it into a monitor.
I think this is just incredible. This story is really, it was the concept for one computer, one child.
Nicholas Negroponte's One Laptop Per Child from MIT, I think, was the beginning of this sensibility of giving away cheap computers.
And this is a $25 computer.
Yeah, this was a $25 computer. It's going down. There's a $35 tablet, from India. Was announced. We talked about that about 3 or 4 months ago.
Yeah. And so this is the $25. My only problem is the HDMI input or export, actually. It's the,
hey, give me 5 seconds for our tech friends. 700 megahertz ARM 11, 128 megs of RAM, OpenGL, ES 2.0, 1080p, H.264 high profile video, USB 2.
That's HD, Dr.
Yeah,
Future.
SD memories card slot. General purpose IO, open software like Ubuntu, Python, all this available for $25. Insane.
That's a very powerful little computer.
It is.
And it's the size of a thumb drive.
Yeah. I mean, you could wear it on as with the right packaging, you could probably put it in a watch.
Yeah. Well, they were thinking about, making it so that they can just give them away.
Mm-hmm. Raspberry Pi. Another fine example of how fast this whole evolution is going. Now, the other big evolution.
Oh, wait, Dr. Future.
Yeah. Okay. Well, time for a quick little break, I assume.
Yeah, so give us a little tease. What are you going to be talking about next?
Oh, I'm going to talk about the display. I mean, we've got the computers. Now, what about the display?
What's the evolution? For these little computers?
For anything.
For anything.
Especially these little computers.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll talk to you in a few minutes.
Oh, it looks like we've got a guest.
All right. You're in for a surprise.
Stay tuned.
Okay. All right, talk about a synchronicity. I was just opened the story on MIT News, where we're talking about new glasses-free 3D, and who shows up but Dr. Farb himself from MIT, not MIT News, but MIT Old, right?
Exactly. It's a synchronicity.
Yeah, a synchronicity.
Synchronicity.
And he's going to help us understand a few of these stories from his own unique way. He's kind of a stand-up.
I'm a live-in comic.
Yeah, a live-in comic. Yeah, he's our live-in comic. For
because
the show,
laughter's right? The best medicine, unless you have the clap, in which case take the antibiotics as well.
I was worried I had strep the other day.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah, you sounded pretty bad on the phone. God. Okay, well, to continue the stories here, MIT has announced a new type of glassless free 3D. You know how you have to wear glasses right now to see the movies, the 3D movies? Well, they're trying to get rid of the glasses. People apparently hate glasses. When
yeah, I have to say the glass thing is a real turnoff for the 3D.
Yeah?
Yeah. I don't want to put anything else on my face.
You like it. You like to be unencumbered.
Well, I wear glasses.
Right.
And, you know, we're already blessed with perfect 3D, just using our eyes.
Exactly.
Now, Mrs. Future, though, you were up to date on this story. Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about
it? You described it really well, Mrs. Future.
I was really impressed with this technology because the way that they're getting the 3D effect is to create a stereoscopic effect that targets your left eye and your right eye separately. And so the fundamental insight that they came up with is to create that parallax vision through putting slits in front of the image. And then those slits make it so that your right eye and your left eye are seeing two different pictures. However, this can only be optimized in one direction. So if you move the pad or anything like that, then you don't get the effect. So the MIT team came up with a way of putting lots of different layers to get different angles so that you'd have more angles that worked for this 3D effect. But every time you add a layer, since it's blocking part of the image was getting darker and darker. And so, you know, you were either needing to have more power, which meant, you know, less time or bigger batteries, or you had to do something else to get more light. So what they came up with is very brilliant. They decided to create slits that were in all kinds of different directions so that you'd have a lot more angles that you could get the 3D effect. And after experimenting with a number of layers, they kind of came up with something that was just like a point that would let the light through. And they realized that that wasn't the best solution. So they finally broke through to the idea of allowing a bunch of different slits that would be created according to the surface area of the object that was being projected. So now the object itself is dictating the arrangement of the technology to give you that 3D effect. And of course, then it has angles that correspond with all the angles that you can see the object.
Yeah, the real win is the full parallax motion that it allows.
Parallax.
A display that allows multiple perspectives in both the horizontal and vertical directions.
Right.
Simultaneously.
Very cool.
Yeah, very hot. Yeah. Very hot little number crunching thing. So that's happening. So
that's the future.
Isn't it? No more glasses.
Give me the 3D without the glasses.
Yeah, let the computer do all the work.
Well, one
let
wonders.
Us just look at it.
One wonders if what we're experiencing, which appears to be 3D, might not be a similar kind of an analog, that somehow each item sends light waves back to us, and somehow the way our eyes, because our eyes allow light to come out of them as well as light going into them. So it's the combination of the two that constructs this 3D world.
Well, we're putting something out there, some kind of process.
Well, it appears that light comes from our eyes. It bounces off.
Really?
Yeah.
Actual light?
Light is being emitted from our eyes as well as coming in.
Huh.
But the thing is that a reflection of the light that's outside, or is it, you know, something that's coming from our own little source generator?
Is the brain sophisticated enough to use reflected light?
Sometimes my brain feels really hot.
Overprocessing.
I think I've set like smoke alarms off like that, just with my head alone. Yeah.
Maybe better for your lungs.
I'm glad you spoke up, Janana, because there's a story from your old university that is in the
Purdue
news.
Purdue.
Huh?
See, you got your alumni.
Boilermakers.
Boilermakers.
That's Purdue, the Boilermakers. That's their mascot. Of course, MIT's mascot is the Beaver.
Well, you got us beat there. For
why
sure.
Boilermakers?
Because is a Boilermaker?
A Boilermaker is someone who works with metal and makes boilers.
Oh, I thought maybe it was a drink.
It is.
It is a drink. Yeah, it's a god awful drink.
But that was a kind of ex post facto drink.
It was a glass of beer, and you would throw in a shot.
Right.
And it would go into the beer glass, and then you drink it together. Uh-huh. And boy, you didn't need too many Boilermakers.
To bring you to a boil.
To have you walking funny.
Really, like a shot of vodka or something? Or?
Yeah, I don't remember what. I never did it, So I don't really know.
Did only Boyles drink it or Goyles drink it too?
Goyles. The Goyles and the Boyles. So Purdue's in the news.
So what did they create? What's their
They came up Purdue's had a lot of an amazing innovators and scientists over the years. I'm actually pretty proud of I know MIT is pretty swanky.
No, it's not a competition. Competition is a low form of evolution. Cooperation is where we evolved to once we realize that competition served its function.
I totally agree with that, but that's hardly a perspective I ever hear coming out of MIT.
I understand that. I'm a reconstructed nerd.
So we had a lot of really great inventors come out of it was mostly an agricultural school, but over the years it's become a really hot engineering school.
From what I can see, this was some way of converting non-potable water into drinking water while extracting hydrogen to generate electricity at the same time.
Yeah, it's really amazing how they developed this this new technology that can convert non-potable water into drinking water. Mm-hmm. And while doing this, extracting hydrogen to generate electricity.
Right.
And this could be created very cheaply and could be used in all different... It could use fresh water or salt water.
Or for villages that need drinking water.
Right. Or boats. This came out of the electrical and computer engineering department.
And how are they doing it?
They're using an alloy which contains aluminum, gallium, indium, and tin, and immersing the alloy in the water causes a spontaneous reaction which turns the water into steam. And then they collect the steam, and that's drinkable,
right?
And then it's also generating hydrogen, and the aluminum hydroxide until the aluminum is used up. So it's using the aluminum.
And the hydrogen can be used in a fuel cell.
Yeah. And so it could generate electricity and produce the drinking water.
Mm-hmm. So basically you just drive your car by drinking.
Yeah.
So much for don't drink and drive.
Well, say the steam would kill the bacteria in the water, and then that would condense it
to the purified water.
Yeah. The only thing I didn't like about this, because it is very innovative thinking, and it's a very brilliant way of thinking about how to get a hybrid system that gives you purified water
and
solar electric power, electricity. But the last line tells it all. And when you're done, this byproduct is non-toxic aluminum something or
hydroxide.
Hydroxide, and that can go to the landfill.
We got a phone call, Dr. Future.
All right. Bring it on.
This is, I believe, Vernon.
Vernon. All right.
Yeah, I was interested in the 3D stuff.
Oh, yeah, Vernon. Yeah, the 3D glasses?
Yeah.
Non-glasses.
I
think they're on the wrong track.
What, non-glasses? You want glasses?
No, the slits. I think there are other ways. I've just thought about it. Why don't they come up with a holographic video camera? 30 frames per second gives you the appearance of image, and a hologram is not really an image. It's made by using coherent light in a variety of different beams, so you don't really get an image per se. You get a diffraction pattern that, when scattered back, gives you a 3D effect.
I think that's a brilliant insight, Vernon, and I think it's the difference between watching the screen versus projecting the screen. I think that this technology will actually make it possible to do a low-cost hologram.
Yeah, because that's what I, when you look at a hologram, all it's doing is reflecting the incoming light. So what you're doing, I'm just making this up. I have no idea. I haven't done the technology. But I know some of the problems, and like we look at holographic images, stills, and they're not really an image. They're a diffraction pattern.
I take it you want to see Princess Leia.
Sure.
I do too, Vernon.
Well, yeah. You know, you guys talk about augmented reality last week, so that's kind of like not quite like a movie, a 3D movie, but there is the 3D effect of that.
Well, I'm hoping we talk about augmented reality this week too, Vernon.
In fact,
I think we got a really great article
coming. But if you can shoot 30 frame per second holograms, continuous holograms as the actors act, maybe there's some way to do that. I don't know.
Well, I think they're moving in that direction, Vernon. One of the newest video games that's really hotsy-totsy that's coming out is called L.A. Noire.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And they used real people to create the avatars in the game. Hmm. And it's I think it's going to be huge. And it's by Rockstar Videos, Rockstar Games. And they're the ones who made Grand Theft Auto 1, 2, 3, and 4. And this is where they take, I think they're using 7 cameras to videotape just the face and the expressions of the real actor.
Motion capture,
and then placed on the avatars. Wow. And so you have these, they're creating actors.
Vector actors.
I know. It's incredible. I think that's great. Put all the actors out of work and we get the technology down. It's probably cheaper.
Well, you know, what's interesting is they are using actors
to evolve.
Yeah, it's a new classification of work for actors. In fact, radio people can now start acting.
Well, you know, I think the thing is that it's possible if they're doing that, if you can just get the motions down, you don't have to be particularly really convincing on the screen like an actor is. You might be able to get doubles. There might be a lot of people out there that could, in quotes, act that are not professionally trained actors that could do a good job for the created film.
That's an interesting
thing. I don't know.
All right. Well, thanks for calling, Vernon.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Have a great day.
Yes, I will.
I bet you will.
In terms of the holographic thing, I'm not sure that they're able to do it in 3 dimensions. Most holograms are on 2 dimensions. They're, you know, we see them on our credit cards and that kind of thing. And yeah. I think what they're talking about with that development at MIT is something that wherever you are, it's going to appear 3-dimensional. Whereas holograms, I'm still not quite sure if we can do it in 3 dimensions or if it appears this, you know,
yeah,
like
I think
if you
you're
go
right.
around
I
behind.
Yeah, I think it's an interference pattern of light, so it does need some kind of substrate to be the
right.
surface where
right.
that pattern is recognized. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the holy grail is to have a floating 3D image in the air right in front of you with no discernible source of transmission. Or
sure,
just kind
well,
of appears.
You know, if you put enough particulates in the air, you know, then those could be used.
Yeah, you could even use vapor.
Or maybe the combination of lasers from different directions, you know, that where the intersection of the lasers from different directions would create a visible effect.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Well, but, you know, even when we've seen that, you know, we've seen that at Burning Man where we saw lasers that were being projected out into the air and even cross. It seems like the lasers didn't really show up unless there was smoke in the air that they could hit.
Typically, but I'm thinking that if they are coherent light, they're very specific photons in very specific directions, and that there are different colors of lasers. We have red, green, and blue lasers now, and the combination of the three intersecting each other might be interesting, or there might be a way in which they can luminesce or impact each other in some way. I don't know. I'm just speculating on this. I do know that we have red, green, blue laser projectors now that do work on a projected surface. And what's really exciting about them is that they don't need any lens. Like if you have instead of a standard video projector, you have a video projector that uses a laser, it's always in focus. You never have to focus it. So, like, for example, if you put up several screens at different distances from the projector, they'll all be in focus. Everything will be in focus.
Very cool.
Yeah. So you could have things in, you know, gossamer things in the air that capture some of the light here and there, and it'll all be in focus. Or if you project on somebody's clothes, you'll see the image always in focus as they move. you know, like dancers with certain patterns on from the projector.
Or if the projector had some kind of a puff, you know, like when in some clubs they have smoke machines that put, you know, natural aromatic essences into the air, and you could just put something that was steamy that made it possible to do
a light
show.
And it would stay in focus, yeah. It would stay in focus and would be, it would reflect the steam, yeah.
So you could develop high self-esteem.
High fidelity self-esteem.
It's a picture of yourself, would definitely be self-esteem. Yeah.
Well, the good thing about narcissism is you don't have to think about other people.
Well, and speaking of not speaking to other people, there's another article we have called Talking to the Wall.
Nice segue, Al.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. And it's an experimental interface designed from the Microsoft Labs, which... Or just calling in now.
Yeah, we sure have a lot of callers today. How about if everybody, instead of calling on our cell phones, why don't you call on the KSCO line, which is 479-1080.
This is Agent Nada's.
And then we can put you on the radio.
Let us know if we're not supposed to talk about this. Yeah, I'm going to try. I'm going to get as much as I can.
Okay, anyway, talking to the wall.
This is an experimental interface. This is really interesting because what this does, it turns any wall into an interactive surface. Okay, and
say that again.
It turns any wall into an interactive surface.
For what sense?
Well, all right. Well,
touch.
It could
sight,
allow
hearing.
No. The actual insight is that you know we're moving around in a sea of invisible frequencies, right? We have wireless interfaces, we have radio waves, and this technology that's being developed allows the wall, which has some kind of embedded circuitry, you know, say light switches or something like that, to be accessed using the human being as a conductor.
A radio antenna.
A radio antenna. So the wireless signals that are in the air can be transmitted through the human being to the wall. And so, you know, for what it's worth, then the human being can use that connection to do something with that.
So yeah. You could take your pulse by putting your hand against the wall?
Well, the applications have yet to be discovered. All that's discovered right now is that the invisible radio waves can be channeled through the human being when they touch the wall.
They say that there's lots of ambient electromagnetic radiation emitted by our home appliances, our mobile phones,
right.
Our computers.
And our bodies.
And electrical wiring within the walls is usually considered noise.
Mm-hmm.
But... in this case, the researchers chose to put it at the core of the interface. So when you touch a wall with electronic wiring behind it, you become an antenna that tunes the background radiation, which produces a distinct electrical signal depending on your body position, your proximity to the wall.
Hmm.
And this unique signal can then be collected and interpreted by a device in contact with or close to your body. And so when you touch a spot on the wall behind a couch, the gesture could be then recognized and can be used to, say, to turn down the volume on the stereo.
Yeah. So basically you could build an interface so that the wall would just respond to your touch, and you could build a remote control so that you have something in your pocket to tell the wall what to do.
Hmm. Right. That's interesting.
Yeah.
It reminds me of a joke.
Yeah, what's that?
Remember the Wailing Wall?
Yeah.
Well, CNN was at the Wailing Wall, and they noticed this old Jewish guy came down every day, morning and night, and he prayed, and he stuck a note in the wall.
5 seconds.
5 seconds.
And anyway, the CNN guy said, "You've been doing this for so long. What are you praying for?" He said, "Peace in the Middle East." And the guy says, "How do you feel?" He says, "Like I've been talking to a wall."
And on that note. Let's come back with some topical news for today. The fact that Skype was bought by Microsoft.
I don't know if that's a good thing.
Microsoft is buying Skype for $8.5 billion, staggering amount of money.
That's very good for the inventors.
That's more than what Redmond has ever paid for anything in terms of a company.
Well, that's valuable
Redmond,
connection software.
Redmond,
Washington.
Washington
Redmond,
Giants.
Washington,
Microsoft.
Microsoft.
The
code
town
name
in which Microsoft
right.
has their headquarters
yes,
for our dear audience.
The
yes.
Redmond Giants.
You'd think that Bill Gates would have a cell phone. Why would he have to buy Skype?
Well, maybe he wants other people to use something other than... I don't know.
What's particularly puzzling is that Skype doesn't exactly print money. They haven't been making money.
Well, I've got to imagine this is in the chat wars. You know, we've got Google Chat, we've got Apple iChat, and you know, Microsoft kind of needs to be in the game because the internet's going to eat everything. It's going to eat the phones. It's going to eat the television. It's going to eat the movies. So, of course, Microsoft wants to be positioned when it eats the phones.
That's why we call it the Uber brain.
Right. Well, Ballmer considers Microsoft to be the Uber company because, to quote him on this, he says, "We're irrepressible. This Skype acquisition is completely consistent with our ambitious, forward-looking, irrepressive nature. Microsoft and Skype will bring together hundreds of millions, or as Tony said, billions of consumers and empower them to connect in new and exciting and interesting ways. It's a core to our mission, and it's a core to our technology direction," says Ballmer, CEO of Microsoft.
When what does he bias his opinion?
The fact that he's probably been Microsoft CEO for quite a while now.
Well, I've got to imagine that Skype has got some really great patents. Because, you know, they've been providing this encrypted communication service, and nobody's gone after them.
Well, they are the poster child of voiceover internet protocol.
For
voiceover IP, and just about everybody uses it, even though there are many other competitive services.
VoIP.
Right, exactly.
I bet it's going to get more expensive in the hands of Microsoft.
Could be. It was founded in 03. eBay paid $3.1 billion for it in 05. And then they sold most 70% of it off in 09 for $1.9 billion.
That was under Meg Ryan's leadership, right?
Yeah.
Not Meg Ryan, Meg Whitman.
Mitwin. Yeah, sorry, forgot her name.
Meg Ryan, I believe, is that actress.
Yeah, yeah.
Meets
she
people.
Probably would have sold it for a profit.
So well, what do we use Skype
Sleepless
for?
In Seattle. I think there might be a connection.
Oh, I would have gotten more votes.
Well, why do you use Skype? Cheap international calls?
Free.
Free, right. That's the operative word. See, that's why people can't quite figure this
visual,
out.
Visual.
Oh, you
visual.
Like the video?
Yeah,
I don't
yeah.
particularly, but I do know that people really like that they can see people even if they're moving at three-quarter speed.
I could see my nephew's baby.
Yeah, it was sweet. Huh?
I like using Skype because you don't have to use iPhone minutes if you've got a data plan. Right? You can Skype people through your iPhone, and then it doesn't matter how many minutes you use, uh-huh. as long as you have Skype minutes.
Then you haven't switched over to using FaceTime?
No.
I tried to FaceTime you.
Oh, guess I have to get on board.
FaceTime is the Apple.
And you weren't there.
You need to call me to tell me to turn on my FaceTime. That'll work.
Just come over, knock on the door, say, "I'm about to have FaceTime with you." Oh, we have it right now. It's called Meet Space.
I'm old school. I'm old fashioned that way.
Well, some would say Microsoft's purchase is arguably as much about defense as offense. It denies Skype, for example, from Facebook or Google, who are other potential
buyers
for this. And both of which had been very interested in partnering with and possibly buying it. And as carriers de-emphasize what's being commoditized by minutes, Microsoft's alliance with Nokia is also interesting. And perhaps the Nokia-Skype combo will help put Microsoft back in the game with the mobile computer platform, you know, to compete with Windows 7 phones versus iPhones and Google's Android. So there's a lot of strategic thinking going on the corporate level with this.
Well, I think it's interesting because I think both of the user interfaces on Skype and Microsoft Windows sucks.
Yeah, I think so too.
And so there's no chance it's going to get better now. I'm constantly confused by Skype. I mean, yeah. I can get it to work.
Like add a contact is more complicated than it should be.
It's terrible. terrible.
Well, but you never know, because Microsoft is always hiring. Like, it's possible that they will get some new talent, just, you know, acquiring the right person for the job, and they'll finally get a decent mobile interface.
Well, the user experience is really important. Yeah. And I think that's the big reason why Apple is outperforming any of the other smartphones, is because of the user interface and the ease.
Well, the hope is that it will easily combine with email, voice and video as one data stream. You know, that's their hope, that they'll have one good communications device out of this.
I hope so for them.
Yeah, well, you know, when you're Johnny come lately and you can see what's going on at Google, you can see what's going on at Apple, and you have deep pockets, then you can probably keep up. Right?
I bet Bill would love to hear you say Johnny come lately.
Well, Bill is just, you know.
Bill Gates, that is.
I know, but Bill is no longer in the driver's seat. This is all about Steve now, right? Steve Ballmer.
Well, I think the real winner out of this is the company that got the $8.5 billion from Microsoft.
Yeah.
I think
Skype
that
guys.
The Luxembourg-based company that owns it had bought it back. I think they had been the original designers, and they bought it back cheap from eBay. They sold it a lot for.
Were they from Luxembourg or Sweden or
Luxembourg?
Luxembourg.
Okay.
Yeah. So the investment group that bought it in 2009 is going to be probably coming up with something even hotter than any of this stuff. Because if they design Skype and they get that kind of money, what do you think they're going to come up with next? So I say keep an eye on those developers that came up with Skype in the first place, now that they're properly financed.
Hopefully they'll find some good user experience engineers.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know, I keep hyping on it, but I've been using Skype for years, and it's been it's not satisfying. I mean, it is when it's working, but getting connected.
Mm-hmm. Have you tried using it on your iPhone, Skype?
Yeah. And my iPad.
And you haven't been satisfied with that
no,
experience?
No, I know how to use it now.
Yeah.
But
okay.
Sometimes it trips me up.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see. We'll see what happens with that.
I'm worried. I think it's going to get worse. I think it's going to be like all the problems I had with Microsoft is now going to happen with Skype.
Oh, okay. Well, let's hope that goes away.
I see something about Skype.
Hey, Michael Olson. Everybody's got something to say about this.
I just wanted to say something nice about Skype.
Yeah. Perfect.
I was just out in the South Pacific and hard pressed to communicate with back in the United States because nothing worked except Skype.
All right.
So when my smartphone could get access to Wi-Fi, I could call home for a nickel from like Perth, Australia.
Wow.
That's cool.
That is very cool.
It was
very
cool.
All
right. I challenge Microsoft.
Now, was that a nickel Australian or a nickel American?
In the future.
But how in the heck do you make any money doing that?
That's the big question. Yeah, that's what
if I had a nickel for every time I was asked that.
Well, the good thing is, you know, Skype came from the days when the internet used to be free, and a nickel seemed like a lot because everything was just being invented and people were sharing their information instead of thinking that it had to be more expensive than people should have to pay because there are no costs.
Yeah.
Suddenly now everything's becoming expensive and there are costs, i.e., joint venture capitalists that need to be paid.
Well, on this subject, I would just like to ask Dr. Future and the assembled agents, how do you think the internet is going to be turned into a money-generating thing? Do you think they're going to make it into... You know, separate areas you have to pay, cable TV. You get a certain package, you get a premium package, you get a deluxe package. Or is it going to be speed? You know, if you pay the extra $20 a month, then you get it.
Better connection.
You know, I think people who like to get paid are the ones asking this question, and I really think that things get invented. And then people figure out how to use it to make money, and that the economy always exists because people are trading things of value back and forth. And so the models are going to be invented by people using it to create value. And those are going to emulate things that are already working.
Dr. Future, Mrs. Future, Dr. Farb, we've got a phone call here from Wisconsin. Hey, Carl, welcome.
Cheesehead.
Hello.
Hey, Carl. Do you hear us?
Yes. Hello. How are you?
Good, good, good. Yeah. Do you have a question on this Skype thing?
I do, but I have more of a comment as well.
Okay.
And so I just found out, just by turning Dr. Future on the internet radio, that I guess Skype is getting bought out by Microsoft?
Right. Yeah.
Oh, only one comment to say to that.
Yeah, what's that?
Oh, no.
You think they'll botch it?
Makes you cry, doesn't it, Carl?
No.
Makes me cry, too.
Microsoft will...
It's a drill, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Here's something the article says, that it may be a challenge to convert Skype's 8 million paying users and to convert them from non-paying to paying. Yeah, right.
Oh,
darn. Oh. I hope it's a big challenge. I hope they don't win that challenge.
I had never noticed the similarity between pain and paying.
Oh.
Until now.
Because I like to put the pun in punishment.
Well, that surely just takes out everything that I found good about Skype. You know, to say that we were all using it for free around the world, and then paying to communicate by, you know, like telephones, right?
Yeah.
That was the secret. That was the formula.
Well, you know, the good thing that they say is the result of this is that one possibly awful thing won't happen, and that is that Microsoft has made sure that the company will be kept out of reach of Google and Facebook. Now, are we sure that we want Microsoft to be the keeper of the keys? Maybe Google or Facebook would be better. I don't know.
So that's like some lion, you know, taking a hold of the carcass of something and saying, yes, the hyenas won't get it, you know.
Well, really? Bomber has indicated he has no intention to take the carriers like the AT&T and Sprint into an aggressive attempt to bring VoIP into Windows Phone 7.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he says the partnership and the collaboration that he has with the carriers is still fundamental to Windows 7. So that's kind of interesting. I mean, because if they did bring in Skype seriously against the carriers, that would herald a whole new type of cell phone.
Sure.
Based on voice over IP. So
where are you?
It's really bad news, though, because I don't see the upside for my use of Skype, or the way I use Skype, because I don't use it for smartphones. I just use it on my Apple computer. You're welcome, Steve. But, you know, it just sits there, and I'm able to chat most of the time, and I video call some people every so often. And now, is it true, though, that I'm going to have to pay to do that now?
No, there's nothing that's been said about that.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that.
Where are you in Wisconsin, Carl?
Just outside of Milwaukee.
Nice.
Place called Brookfield. It's a rather suburban area outside of Milwaukee.
Very nice. Do you have cows?
Do I have what?
Cows.
Oh, no. No, I don't have cows. I do have some cows, but no.
Why do you ask that, Tucker?
Well, because Wisconsin is
cow country,
cheeseheads.
Actually, yeah, it is. And it's probably a friend of mine has his own cow. They actually go in on a cow every year, and they raise a cow for their meat.
A cow a year, huh?
Usually a cow a year. They know that where what goes into the cow, so they're really picky about what goes into their, you know, because they don't trust the regular growers of cows, if you will.
And do they take the cow to the movies?
I don't know. The cows out here are pretty healthy right now, and they haven't heard of anything showing up from Fukushima with the cows out here. Like, they have some of the cows, I guess, in Oregon showed up with traces amount of radioactivity. So I guess we're pretty rad hardened, haha.
All right. Well, thanks a lot.
Good. Stay safe out there.
Yeah, thanks for checking in.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Okay, right. So we're about to go to the break at the top of the hour. Yep. Sacred Geometer, Jonathan Quinton.
And what else we got? We got a whole bunch. Is Dr. Favre going to hang out?
Yeah, I think he'll hang out for a little bit with us and cover a few more stories.
Happy to join you.
Stay tuned. KSCO Santa Cruz.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We've been talking about the whole Skype Microsoft convergence. And and our guest has arrived from New Zealand, Jonathan Quinton, who uses Skype quite regularly. Isn't that right, Jonathan?
I do. I'm a regular user of Skype.
Yeah? Do you like it?
Well, I have a love-hate relationship with it.
Oh, love-hate. Uh-huh. And what do you think of Microsoft buying Skype?
I'm a little bit wary of that.
Well, you are a Windows 7 user, right? I mean, you use a Windows machine. You're not a Mac
No, I'm PC, that's right, but I'm just a little bit wary of anything that's too big, you know. I like diversity.
Okay, all right, so not exactly a vote of confidence here on this convergence.
No.
Okay, well, Jonathan was born and raised in New Zealand. From an early age, he was attracted to the beauty of nature, and he's taken an unusual tack with his love of nature, and that he has worked with what we call sacred geometry. Now, is it fair to say that the sacred geometry is the geometry of nature?
Definitely, yeah. Sacred geometry, you know, is a vast field of geometry, but most particularly it tracks nature. It looks at the self-organizing forces and mm-hmm. the patterns and forms and you know, cycles and rhythms and all these sorts of things, and expresses mm-hmm. it through pictures.
Mm-hmm. I guess, what's the best example, do you think, for most people to identify a nature geometry? Like a seashell, like the spiral of a seashell?
Yeah, a nautilus seashell is a really good example, because mm-hmm. the nautilus seashell expresses the golden ratio, which is a geometric principle, mm-hmm. and on three different dimensional planes. On one dimensional spiral, it's linear spiral, mm. is what is called a Fibonacci spiral, golden spiral. Mm-hmm. The shell itself conforms to golden proportions, and each chamber, as it proceeds outwardly, has approximately 1.618 times more volume than the chamber preceding it.
Now, how in the world did nature come up with that?
That's right, because a mollusk doesn't go to geometry school, you know.
Yeah,
it just,
right.
It does this of its own accord.
Why would it choose that out of thousands of possible geometries?
Because that is the most efficient one out of all the other, you know, endless numbers of geometries. That's the time-proven, most effective, most optimal system.
Most optimal for what?
For life. You know, for seed distribution, for maximum exposure to the sun, maximum exposure to the rain, to the components, nutrients, all of these things. Optimal seed distribution.
Hmm. So nature goes for most bang for your buck.
That's right, for sure. Yeah, nature gets the most out of the least.
Hmm. Now, how did you express your fascination for this? You became an artist to some extent, right?
Well, I finally succumbed to the artist within me.
After you were a radio operator for a while or something?
For some years I was a radio operator at sea, on ships at sea, and also with the United Nations in the Middle East. I did that for a few years, and I did photography for a few years. But then it got to the point where my love and passion for geometry, sacred geometry specifically, just became so overwhelming that I resigned from the United Nations so I could pursue the investigation, artistic expression, and the experience, the holistic experience of sacred geometry full time, so I could just pursue it for, dedicate my life to it.
So basically, what were some of the first artistic expressions you created?
Well, I read about these five forms called the five Platonic solids, named after Plato. Plato used these forms, which are five generic.
Like the circle, the square.
Well, no, it's five forms that are carved from a sphere. Just imagine you have a sphere of butter and a hot knife calibrated so you can cut at any angle. Mm-hmm. And the intention is to sculpt five forms out of these five spheres of butter. Mm-hmm. Then using the least number of cuts, of slices, you would actually get five forms, five geometric forms called the five Platonic solids.
Oh, I see, the tetrahedron, the cube, the octahedron, the duodecahedron, and the icosahedron?
Yeah, dodecahedron and icosahedron. Yeah, these are the five self-organizing forces, the structures.
Can we go over those a little slower and name, like give us a little
story about each one?
Description of what they look like?
Yeah, back to our example of a sphere of butter, mm-hmm. and your hot knife, mm-hmm. then the aim is to sculpt a geometric form. It must be symmetrical so that all the edges are the same length and all of the facets that you carve from the sphere are all identical, and that the same number of these shapes meet in the same way all around the form. Well, the least amount of cuts you could take from a sphere to create a form is four. Mm. And that would leave you with what is called the tetrahedron, which is four triangles. Basically, it's a three-sided pyramid, mm-hmm. with another triangle as the base. So that's called the tetrahedron. And it's made up of three equilateral triangles.
Three equal-sized triangles.
Yeah, equilateral, yeah. Uh-huh. And then continuing on to another sphere, because you've got five spheres, then the next least amount of slices to create a form is six. And that creates what is called the hexahedron, but we're all familiar with it as a cube. Hmm. And it's a form of, it's a hexahedron because it's six square facets.
That's the perfect cube.
It is. That's a perfect cube, which is sculpted from the sphere.
From the sphere. You're always starting with the sphere as the source.
The sphere represents the cosmic womb in sacred geometry, the source of undifferentiated potential and infinite possibility. Mm. And from the sphere in geometry, five forms emerge, which are, you know, the only five forms that share the features of all of their facets are equal, are the same, are symmetrical all the way around, and all of the edges are the same length.
So we have the three with the tetrahedron, the four, which is a cube, and the hexahedron, and then there's...
Well, there's five forms, and three of them are triangular, and one of them is square, which is a cube. Mm-hmm. One of them is pentagonal, which is the dodecahedron, which is if you take 12 slices from the sphere, you get this form that is made up of 12 pentagons, or 12 pentagonal facets.
12 perfect pentagons.
Isn't one pentagon enough?
Well,
look at what the Pentagon has done to all of us. Oh, sorry.
No, that's a really good example, actually, of how, you know, these universal symbols can get a bad name. You know, because also in the medieval times, you know, the pentagram star, the five-pointed pentagram star, was considered to be evil, satanic. And,
really?
You know, and they would place it in an inverted fashion. Then it would fit up against the front view of a goat's head, you know, which represents Satan. And so they had all of these, you know, affiliations and coincidences between the pentagram and Satanism. And even today, you know, some fundamentalists still consider it to be an evil symbol. But really, it's geometry, the symbols in geometry.
It's a fundamental geometric shape?
A mathematical compositions, a pure mathematical principles, a fundamental shapes, and they are beyond evil. They always have been, they're pre-existing mathematical principles that have forever been and, you know, will be forever because they, Plato said that geometry existed before the creation. Because geometry doesn't require anything. It doesn't require a Big Bang or anything else other than it is.
Hmm.
And so it is a representation of the what we might call the cosmic mind, the universal mind.
So it's the very basic ideas of reality itself are imbued in Platonic, but not just human consciousness, but the form, matter itself can be
Creation itself and how matter and force or particle and force or even spirit and the physical form integrate.
Well, so when you were first getting into this, did you start just drawing these basic Platonic solids because they were the fundamental and you started playing with them in various artistic ways? Was that your process?
Well, with the five forms, it wasn't drawing, it was building because I three-dimensional.
Oh, in three dimensions. So you actually had...
Yeah, so I built. I started building because I read... In Keith Critchlow's book, Mathematics of the Cosmic Mind, I was reading how each one of these five forms can contain the other four perfect, cradled perfectly within it.
Hmm.
So it could take any one of the forms, for example, the icosahedron, and nest the other four perfectly, starting from the octahedron at the center, fitting into the tetrahedron, which fits into the hexahedron, which fits into a stellated dodecahedron, which fits into an icosahedron, and its name is octatetrahexastellatedodecaicosahedron.
Okay, I sort of get it.
Say that again. Say that again.
Can you say it one more time?
Octatetrahexastellatedodecaicosahedron.
Wow. Okay.
Not to be confused with an icosa octatetrahexadodecahedron, which are quite different. The same in many ways, but very different also.
Now, do you actually create these?
I didn't. Well, God created these.
I built That's right. You had these three-dimensional rotating structures that you carry with you very often.
Well, I used to. It just became too much of a logistical nightmare to fly with them so much because I had to break them down and rebuild them and, you know.
I can see you explaining them to customs with the
and that too, yeah.
TSA has a special geometry department.
They do, huh?
They do not fit in your carry-on luggage. unless they're much smaller than the ones you carry.
Yeah.
That's true. They're like the size of like two or three basketballs, at least, in terms of...
all different sizes, because leading back to what I was saying, I read how, you know, each form, as Keith Critchlow wrote, that could contain all the others within, and this just seemed too fantastical, you know, to me to be real, so I actually had to build them. So I could see them from my very own eyes that it was indeed true, and I did, and it is, which is amazing, and many other amazing relationships, interrelationships.
So actually seeing them really led to the next thing for you, the next thing. You actually would create newer and newer geometries. Well, good. Well, after the break, let's look at where you take this, and I believe it ties into the power of mandalas and what that is.
It's more than pretty pictures, you know. It's something that can be used for our benefit,
for pragmatic effects. Good.
Yes.
Oh, well, thank you. Stay tuned for Jonathan Quinton on Sacred Geometry. Show, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We are here on the air with Jonathan Quinton in from New Zealand talking about sacred geometry. Carl, our listener, just sent in information on the pentagram and how vast amount of information is just on that particular shape alone. I think I remember the pentagram was something that Pat Flanagan once shared with me, that you can fold an American dollar bill so that it forms the perfect pentagram, and that the pentagram was considered a sacred object back in the ancient Greece days, and that to talk about it was not allowed in public. It was part of secret society information back at that time. Is that true generally with sacred geometry? Was it part of secret society?
Oh, definitely. You know, it was only available to the initiates who had proven via dedication and intelligence and you know, desire to enter into this field.
So it's safe to say it's some of the earliest form of mathematics that our species started to figure out.
That's a way of looking at it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Didn't Pythagoras have a school that was specifically directed in this way towards the mathematics?
Yeah, the Pythagorean school, and actually he's one of my biggest geometric inspirations is Pythagoras, and you know, I often call it Pythagorean geometry because it's so vast, and you know, it runs under so many different titles, including Pythagorean, including Platonic, including ancient, and many titles, and really it doesn't matter what the title, because what matters is the symbols, which are representative of harmonic divisions of the circle. And you know, the primary ones, what are called the archetypes, are the three uniform divisions of a circle, which produce the three primary shapes: the equilateral triangle, the square or quadrilateral, and the pentagon, 3, 4, and 5 uniform divisions of a circle. And they are actually mathematical programs that contain within them dynamics that we find as the self-organizing forces of nature, such as, you know, points of contraction and expansion, lines of force, radials of force, interangular relationships, which express themselves out in nature as, you know, laws of progression and organization.
Mm-hmm. And we can start using some of those principles in building our own architecture and structures. Like, I think motion
There's evidence of that all around in the ancient civilizations. You know, the ancient civilizations, which existed thousands of years apart and thousands of miles apart, and in most cases didn't know of each other's existence, yet they all use the same geometric principles in the architecture and structure of these amazing monuments, you know, the pyramids and the temples and, even, you know, up to the Gothic cathedrals.
All applying these basic...
Applied the same principles, the same root powers, you know, golden ratio, root 2, root 3, which are principles inherent in the five Platonic solids and inherent in the three primary shapes, the triangle, square, and pentagon. And so before the break you'd mentioned, you know, so where does this lead to? Mm-hmm. Or where has it led me to?
And mandalas.
And
so let's tell the audience what a mandala is.
A mandala is a configuration, a geometric configuration of shapes, different shapes, all converging together in perfect arrangement and perfect concordance around a circle and harmonic interwoven togetherness. Mm-hmm. All these different shapes, you know, it's...
Are they used in conjunction with prayer?
Well, they can be, you know, and they have been, and don't necessarily need to be. It depends who's using them for what. Mm-hmm. Because these are, you know, mathematical principles that existed long before there were any religions or philosophies of any type, before there were any galaxies or stars or anything.
These are pre-existing conditions.
They are, yes, yes. And so they can be used, you know, in different ways, including through religion, but including psychologically and philosophically outside of any religion. And that's what I do. That's what I use the sacred geometry configurations for, as like tuning forks, because they are harmonic modulators that represent these universal principles, these harmonics, these states of universal order.
And how exactly do you do this?
I follow certain mathematical principles of harmonic progression, and through trial and error, usually, and through some rather unusual life experiences, have, you know, figured out ways to unravel these mysteries that have, you know, remained mathematical puzzles, and found a way of revealing the state of universal order that exists through these geometries. See, this is one of the most valuable things of sacred geometry, is that it provides tangible evidence of universal order, of a profound, pre-existing, all-pervading universal order that can be seen in these geometric arrangements, which are, you know, you can get millions of stars, different sized stars, to come together in perfect alignment and...
In your artwork?
In my artwork, yeah, well, not maybe not millions in my artwork segments that, you know, tap into infinite processes, which would be, you know, infinite number of stars.
Hmm. So, Jonathan, where could someone go online to see your work?
I have a lot about this on my website, which is www.sacredgeometry.com.au.
All right, sacredgeometry.com.au.
AU, is that Australia?
No, it's the element gold.
Oh, AU. I see, yeah. Okay.
Jonathan, of course, is from New Zealand.
And coincidentally, Australia uses it also, but, you know, they're a bunch of crooks. They'll take anything from anyone.
In this country, AU is American University. Try to keep it, you know, domestic here.
Well, this ongoing feud between AU and NZ is quite profound. Yeah. However, they do ultimately share a lot with each other.
Actually, it's all in good fun. You know, we're best of friends. Because
yeah,
that's all we got down there in that part of the world. It's just the two of us, and we're surrounded by Asian nations. So.
Oh, you know, in the news today, in Dr. Future's links, there's a link of a really important event that just happened affecting Australia and New Zealand, which is that Samoa just decided to change their official designated time zone to match Australia and New Zealand, instead of previously they had been in the United States time zone. So that's news, you know, that as someone from New Zealand, I'm sure you'll be very vitally interested in.
Well, not for that reason, but for another reason that you brought that up, because that's a very important feature of sacred geometry, is time, actually natural time. And that's the whole point, is... we're not moving in natural time. We're following a mechanical clock when time is organic. And a synthetic calendar that was produced, I think it was 1542 or thereabouts, and has to be recalibrated, you know, every few years to bring it back into alignment.
So, Jonathan, is there a more accurate, more fundamental... way of looking at time?
Something more in tune with nature and
well,
sacred geometry?
That's what the mandalas are about, and the five platonic solids and the geometries that emerge from the uniform divisions of the circle.
Well, how does it move, though, through time? Isn't motion time? Isn't the evolution?
Well, it's... Like it's
the growth of a seed to a plant time, something... Isn't there an element that nature knows about time that...
There's this innate harmony, you know, natural rhythms and cycles and seasons, and something even beyond that, something beyond the seasons and something beyond the birth and death of stars, something that, you know, existed well before then.
Hmm.
and will continue on for even more. And that is these geometries, which are harmonic modulators, which are the rhythms, you know, they're the generators. And the Pythagoras called it music of the spheres.
So they're not just still images. They're harmonic resonating forms.
Everything has a vibration. You know, if you draw a triangle, it has a vibration of a triangle. Mm-hmm. If you draw a square, then of a square, or a pentagon, or a circle. Every shape has a vibration, but there are a few shapes that have harmonic vibrations, just like there are a few notes that are resonant and harmonic with each other. It, so too in geometry. In fact, geometry is a visual form of music, as Pythagoras described it. Geometry measures the relationship of number and space, and music measures the relationship of number and time, and they're very complementary and work well with each other in that regard. And Pythagoras demonstrated how the same ratios exist in geometry as they do in the diatonic musical scale.
So you can really get into mathematical scales in understanding.
Well, that's what the shapes are. You know, they show us the scales, the harmonic scales,
harmonic resonating scales,
visual scales.
So is there a scale of that you can play like an instrument then?
Well, that's what I do. That's what my art is about.
Oh, okay. So yeah. You're really a musician as much as a visual artist.
A visual musician, yeah. And I use shapes as the instruments of a celestial orchestra.
And color?
And colors is very important. I use colors for, first of all, from the color schemes that, you know, I've seen in nature, and also in terms of their chromotherapeutic qualities and features and the effect and the impact that it's going to have on human consciousness, all of which is designed to be beneficial and harmonic, and to help to attune the viewer into the harmony of universal order, to help move back into natural time and into wholeness, and to move in harmony with the changes that we're experiencing right now. Because, you know, a lot of people are experiencing anxiety at the upheaval and turmoil that's going on all around us. And sacred geometry is a way that can help us move through this, which is why there's been this huge renaissance since the turn of the century, this huge awakening of sacred geometry. I've been doing it for decades, and now suddenly it's like flavor of the month because people are catching on quick now. You know, we're at that point, we're at that really critical point where things are coming to the surface, and these geometries that were once only available to the most dedicated initiate is now freely available to those that seek it.
To anyone who has the interest.
Because, you know, we're at a pivotal, critical point of our evolution, and consciousness, the sum total of mass consciousness, is going to determine which way things go. And so we have this opportunity at this time to experience these accelerated modalities of developing and opening our consciousness so that we can be ready, we can make the most of, you know, what's ahead of us. And it helps to tap into and actualize more of our potential, because we're only using such a small part of our brain capacity and our optimal potential. Sacred geometry helps us connect with that, with the greater whole. Sacred geometry helps to dissipate the illusion of separation.
Now, I must say that when I've experienced your concerts, it is almost like a visual classical musical piece. Only you're seeing these visual geometries changing with light and dark and color, and in a very compelling manner. Now, I understand you've created a whole new show for this trip to the U.S.
Yeah, it's my latest development, the interaction or the alchemical interplay between radiant color and reflective color. Hmm. And I've painted this series of sacred geometry mandalas, big ones, a square meter or 36 inches square, where I've colored them specifically for how they will respond to colored light in the dark. So that under a red light, they'll tell a completely different story to what they would tell under a blue light or a green light.
Yeah, it's been really remarkable seeing how the geometry changes just by changing the color of light.
Yeah, and to me, you know, I got the idea from the sun, watching the sun, and how during different times of the day, it would cast different hues upon the mandalas and accentuate different features of them and different compositions and different patterns and different archetypes. And so I thought, well, you know, I could accelerate that and accentuate the contrast and accelerate the timing. Yeah. And that's what I've done, you know, because nature creates light, color, shape, pattern, form, ratio, proportion, sound, and motion, and distributes it for the benefit of all living things. And that's what I do with my art. I simulate nature in that way. I take the archetypal shapes and patterns, the harmonics,
and put them out there,
and put them out there with the the stimulation from light and motion and sound.
Mm. Now, when's your show?
It's this Thursday at the Pacific Cultural Center, 1307 Seabright Avenue in Santa Cruz. And there's more information on my website, www.sacredgeometry.com.au, standing for gold, the element gold.
Okay, the Pacific Cultural Center on Thursday night, that's May 12th.
At what time?
7:30?
Starts at 7:30.
7:30.
Great.
All right.
And how much is it?
It's $15 and $10 for unwaged, students and unwaged.
Oh, unwaged. Interesting. Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Jonathan.
Yes, it was a pleasure. Yeah. My pleasure. Right.
And I can tell you, it's a beautiful show. So stay tuned for more documentaries.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. That was Jonathan Quinton on sacred geometry.
Hey, thanks a lot, Jonathan.
Yeah, Thursday night at 7:30 Pacific Cultural Center.
So, Dr. Future, I have someone on the phone, another guest.
All right. Who do we have, Agent Hart?
We have Rob Howeth. Welcome, Rob.
Oh, yeah, hello.
Rob, I hear you're part of Night of the Alien film. Is that true?
Yeah.
So Rob is the producer and production director, designer of Night of the Alien, which is playing this Friday.
At the Santa Cruz Film Festival.
May 13th at the Rio Theater at 9 o'clock.
Is that the closing movie? Or?
No, the closing night is Saturday night.
Saturday.
And that's Rufo.
Okay.
By our other local filmmaker, or now local.
Gotcha.
Rocky Romano, but right now we're talking to Rob Howeth. Hey, thanks a lot for calling into the Dr. Future Show,
yeah.
Rob.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Okay, what can you tell the audience about Night of the Alien?
It looks like, I told them that this is like a Santa Cruz Market movie right here.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's a movie, it's a comedy about science fiction, coming of age, psychedelics, conspiracy theories, witchcraft, pop culture.
Uh-huh.
It's a cross genre movie, but it's a comedy.
Huh. Where does it take place?
The story takes place in Southern California in a desert town. I mean, we don't really say where it is, but somewhere around there.
Uh-huh, an archetypal Southern California desert town. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
how does the alien come in? Is it in a spaceship or?
No. Our two stars of the movie, they pick up a hitchhiker, and the hitchhiker claims to be from the planet Zoltran, and she's an alien. Although the stars that are heroes, they think that she's just tripping on some sort of something.
Some psychedelic.
Exactly.
So,
go ahead.
It's a mashup. There's a band, there's music.
Right. Yeah, we have a great soundtrack. There's music. There's the alien takes them to a the vortex of destiny, and they then all the music ensues and the psychedelics ensue, and but it's all for the greater good of creating a, you know, there's so much negativity on the planet. This is discussed in the movie that the alien is trying to save the planet. So there's a good underlying message
to save us from our own behaviors, huh?
Exactly. Uh-huh.
So, Rob, you've been working on major features for a while now in the role of production designer, and is this the first time you are a producer?
Yeah, it's the first film I produced, and I've been in the industry for about 20 years.
Oh, wow.
In different types of jobs, mostly art department, which in art director and construction and I production designed about 13 films, mostly lower budgets. I did do like reshoots on a Jennifer Aniston movie. So I mean, I have worked with some bigger stars and that kind of thing.
Well, congratulations, Rob. Is this the world premiere of your movie?
It's our, I would say, West Coast premiere, in the sense that we did do a film festival in Kansas City previously.
And how was it received?
Oh yeah, I mean, we got some write-ups, and the audience really enjoyed it, and it was a positive. Everybody felt positive about the film.
So it must be really fun as a producer to have your movie screened with an audience, and there, I'm assuming there was a lot of laughter.
Yeah. Well, it's also nerve-wracking. You know, it's like, you know, you don't know how people are. You know, when you have your baby out there, it's hard to know how it's going to go.
Right.
And I have you on the line here. You must have learned a lot about the new digital way of distributing films these days. What are you trying for this film? How are you getting it out there in the world? Is you going to have it online at iTunes or anything like that?
We may. I mean, we've been approached by some distribution companies to put it together a package for us. Uh-huh. So we don't know. I mean, it's, you know, you have to go through, in my opinion, you have to go through the festival circuit and just see what buzz you can garner from it. So the more buzz you garner, the more, the better a release platform becomes more, tangible.
Uh-huh.
And then different platforms will open up to you based on the amount of, you know, buzz we get.
So how's it going here at the Santa Cruz Film Festival? You having fun?
Oh yeah, and everybody's just really amazing and you know, bending over to help us out, and they really take care of the filmmakers. I'm actually at the hub in downtown Santa Cruz.
That's
at the festival.
That's at 903 Pacific Avenue. People are welcome to go there. That's where you can also buy your tickets specifically for Night of the Alien. That's playing this Friday, March 13th at 9 o'clock at the Rio Theater. The last 2 days of the festival, all the movies will be at the Rio Theater. In between times, like today, tomorrow,
it's the Nick today.
It's at the Nick.
Gotcha. What's been your favorite film so far at the festival?
You know, I just got here, so I can't say
that. That's
can't
okay.
Say that.
That's
right. I mean, I wish I could. We also have, and another interesting thing about our movie is our director, who's also our writer. We have a website, nightofthealien.com, mm-hmm. and he has done a blog, a day by day, if people are interested in making movies, and he broke down our filmmaking process day by day through the 20 days of shooting that we did. And it's some interesting reading, you know, for people who are interested in filmmaking.
Excellent.
Oh, that's it. Yeah, alienmovie.blogspot.com.
Night of the Alien.
Yeah, that's, you can get to it from there. Yeah.
I see.
Uh-huh. Kansas City.
So there's a lot of information there, a lot of good information.
Very, very cool.
So, Rob, how did you hear about the Santa Cruz Film Festival?
Well, one of the co-producers of the movie is from Santa Cruz, and so Pia Helm. And so she's the one that brought it to my attention. And I think we had an article written up in the Good Times as well, where they mentioned her. She loves Santa Cruz. So we also thought it was like a perfect community to see this type of movie in this genre.
I'm going to see what the audience thinks here.
You know, my question to you, I'm curious, how did you decide to start your movie festival tour in Kansas City?
Oh, well, it was kind of a sneak peek there because we wanted, it wasn't quite finished, and so we want, it's like a test audience, so we tested it out there. So, I mean, in fact, this is going to be like the polished first, you know, premiere of our movie, like everything completed and all of the T's crossed and the I's dotted.
Well, it's funny because you think about how easy you've got an audience here in Santa Cruz because, you know, we all love the weird alien psychedelic conspiracy people that we are. But Kansas, if they like you in Kansas, if they laughed in Kansas, that sounds really good, Rob.
Yeah, exactly. That's why it was a little nerve-wracking. But, no, everybody really enjoyed it there.
Hmm. How about computer graphics? Do you have any CGI in the film?
We do, actually. we have some CGI, and we have one of our CGI guys actually going to come up from Los Angeles. And we have, like, there's some shots that he created of the world from outer space, and we have our rocket ship that she supposedly comes on that has, like, pills coming out of the back of it as its propulsion system. And we did a lot of post-production with green screen, and there's a lot of driving shots in the movie. So we've actually had to do a lot of post-production work to finish the film.
Oh, I'm looking at your blog, and I really like your, what is it called, Stoner Spaceships art. Really good to get
exactly.
A preview there.
So the Santa Cruz Film Festival is going on right now. It started last week. We had the director on, Beth Gummery, on last Tuesday, and it's continuing through until Saturday, the 14th of May. And every day there's a bunch of different movies. And
yeah, and we saw Press Play Pause last night.
How was that?
I thought it was an interesting look at the whole digital revolution that's going on right now.
And then also, Dr. Future, you were on a panel at the Digital Media Factory, is that right?
Technology.
Oh, and so was Mrs. Future.
Yes.
Over at the TV station.
Community television. So it was a community television hosted panel on art and technology, where we had some really impressive panel of seminal inventors of the technology that is being used for music, visual, arts, filmmaking.
Computer graphics.
And one thing Santa Cruz Film Festival is known for is the opportunity to meet other filmmakers, such as
Rob Howeth.
Yes.
And so if you have any more questions, our dear audience, please go to santacruzfilmfestival.org.
Or call us in the next 5 minutes.
Oh, and then, of course, to learn more about Night of the Alien, which is Rob Howeth's production, go to nightofthealien.com.
So there's some wild characters here. Esmeralda.
She's actually going to be at the Q&A.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, we have Esmeralda. We have... the alien will be there, and we have some of the other smaller characters are going to be there as well.
Well, it sounds great. So you've got quite a few people that are going to be able to have a discourse and dialogue with the audience after the movie.
Esmeralda.
That will be, I mean, everybody should come see it because there's going to be a lot of questions, and we'll all be there to answer whatever anybody wants to know about.
Esmeralda, boy eater, part-time stripper, evil spellcaster, a magic amulet wielder.
She looks like she's smoking a lot of pot, too, in your trailer.
And the alien's a female also.
Now, I have a question for you, Rob. Is the show tonight at the Nickelodeon?
No, it's on Friday.
Oh, I'm sorry. The show is on Friday at the Rio.
Friday at the Rio.
At 9 o'clock, followed by question and answer with quite a few people of the production.
Good. Well, thank you so much for being part of our show.
Thank you.
Hey, Rob, good luck to you, and I can't wait to see it. The trailer is awesome. Now, you said there was two trailers. One is on the santacruzfilmfestival.org site, but you said there was a better one somewhere?
There was another one that was on YouTube.
On YouTube, okay.
It's called Fran's Fantastic. I think we have it as Night of the Alien, Fantastic Trailer.
Right on. Thanks a lot, Rob. Have a great day. And yeah. I invite everybody out there, please enjoy the Santa Cruz Film Festival as it's happening.
Yeah. That's right.
Are these illegal aliens? I am from INS, and we do not like the illegal aliens. They take our jobs.
Even the interplanetary ones, yes.
Yeah, these illegal aliens are reinventing the concept of jobs.
Is that Steve Jobs?
Hey, thanks a lot, Rob. Have a great day.
All right, thank you.
Just a quick plug for the rest of the Santa Cruz Film Festival. It's ongoing every night and every day between now and May 14th.
Saturday.
The program was in this week's Good Times, so you can read up on all the movies and where they're playing. Primarily this week, during the week, things are at the Nickelodeon.
That's
so
right.
Go down and support your local film festival, see some very unusual films that you might not have another chance to see.
It's a rockin' time at the Hub. You can go down and talk to Rob right now about his new movie,
exactly.
Night of the Alien.
Okay.
So well, we have a couple minutes left. It looks like we have some more people just arrived in the studio.
The party.
Yeah, the party continues. Who do we have here? Oh, it's my brother.
Norm.
Nearly normal.
Yeah.
Hello, nearly normal. Welcome to the show.
Hey, well, glad to be here. I don't have a headphone on, so...
You can't really hear what you're saying.
Right.
Well, the good thing is you can hear the show just using your ears because we're talking into the mics, but you're hearing us in real time.
Right.
Yeah. And he just arrived with an old friend of his, Elliot Handelman. Dr. Handelman, I presume, huh? Yeah. Say something for us. What I know about you.
Well, we've been here assessing the possibilities. We Canadians, you know, I do hail from Canada.
A?
Educated at Princeton,
have been,
though, right?
Yeah, educated elsewhere.
A?
Have been plotting a takeover of the United States by forcible means for some years. We Canadians are planning on marching in here and instituting Medicare as soon as we set up shop. So you Americans had just better watch out.
Ooh, scary.
No matter how sick we are, you're going to heal us.
You're going to be swiping your card through the card reader and getting better whether you like to or not.
But I hear there'll be a long line.
Yeah. All of the best doctors will be emigrating to Canada, that's for sure.
But the line will be part of sacred geometry.
Yeah. Yeah. Many options for making things better here.
Let's hear it for harmonics.
Yeah. Yeah, so Elliot's visiting with Andy. Andy's here.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, everybody. Nice to be on the radio.
Yeah, are you from Canada as well?
Yeah, I am. Montreal. We have a radio show up there, actually. We do a new music show.
Ah.
Yeah.
New music? You mean like what?
Like, you know, as weird as possible. We try and get on the internet and find out what's new, what people are doing, sort of... avant-garde, new stuff, not necessarily pop.
Yeah. Yeah, we like the kind of music which is like about a bunch of European people dragging a giant gramophone horn, like, through a farm to capture the vibrations from the earth and, you know, get a kind of grunting sound as they drag this 5-ton thing through. That's our conception of music.
Now, can internet listeners find your radio show and get these unusual acoustics?
Yeah, we're at wheresthebeat.net and ckut.ca.
Great. KUT.ca. Is that a McGill station?
Huh. Yep.
Well, that's all right. So there you have Variety Plus here on Dr. Future Show.
Yeah, just for your entertainment. Thanks again for listening, folks. We'll see you next week with more interesting reports from the edge of the future.
Yeah, stay tuned for Charlie. He's going to be playing some great oldies but goldies.
It's happy hour.
Have a great day, Santa Cruz. KSCO Santa Cruz.
Is Dr. Future there? Is Mrs. Future there?
Yes. Hi, Corey.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, we're here.
You can talk about us, but we'll hear you.
I, as MZ would say, I'm talking behind your back. but I'm at a distance, so I don't know which way you're facing.
Yeah, we're just getting the download on the new studio here.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen a new studio. How is it? Is it pretty swanky?
Well, right now it's a cardboard cutout. You know, they have a giant piece of cardboard cut out to look like the new desk shape.
Right now it's cardboard and masking tape.
Yeah.
But it has high hopes.
Yeah.
Big aspirations.
It could be.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
That's Billy in the background.
Yeah, Billy's.
Something about John Deere. Your local John Deere dealer.
Yeah, John Deere. I don't know what he's saying, but he's in the other room. He's just looking, making faces, knowing he interrupted us.
No, I like that. We John Deere's a sponsor of the station. We should just talk John Deere talk for the next 5 minutes. So what's going on your show today?
Ooh, it's going to be a party.
Yeah, we're having a party here. We have a few people coming in. We have Jonathan Quinton coming in from New Zealand. And he's the kind of guy that in the past would be the kind of, he'd be like a monk that would work on the design of windows, of the stained glass windows in churches for like a lifetime. And he's got the kind of mind that really is into sacred geometry and form and shape. And he's done stuff with computers that are just a mind blower. And he's doing a show here in Santa Cruz this Thursday, so we thought we'd bring him on and introduce the audience to sacred geometry and what that's all about, the geometry of nature.
Right.
Yeah. So he's one of our guests.
His work is really beautiful, and you can see it on Facebook. Jonathan Quinton is the name that you would search for.
Because nothing screams out good radio like talking about
visuals,
physics, and
it's the theater of the mind.
Yeah.
The theater of the mind.
Describe that tetrahedron. Yes.
But you see, we specialize in our show on having simultaneous internet show and tell. Right. We use the Cinecast system, and we allow our audience to look at what we're talking about if they want to, either in real time or later.
And we try and describe it.
Yeah.
And we like to think about Al's mom out there listening.
Yeah, I was raised by blind parents, so I have a certain capacity for translating visuals into audio. Yeah, it's just try to.
We like to tell the story for the visual experience through the ears.
What's wild is when you think about before TV was around, the studio that you're in right now, which is now going to be the Schwenke Studio, at one time. Back in the 40s, back in the 50s, big bands would go in there and play, and people would envision the big band playing. And people would actually dance in that studio, and they'd go in, now, you know, Alan and Mary dancing. And you'd hear the music, and you'd hear people dancing, and people would envision dancing. And they did, like, shows, you know, somebody's knocking the door. Oh, my gosh, it's Billy, you know. And so that's what radio was. Radio was theater of the mind for a long period of time.
And it was a party, too.
Yeah.
And now with video podcasting and the ability to send the visuals out and people can either listen or watch, depending on their preference, it's going back to that.
And we may have a few other visitors showing up today. We have Dr. Farb, I believe, and also Dr. Handelman from Princeton, McGill, who is an expert in AI and music. And he may be stopping by. He's over at Google right now. Talking to them about some big project. So we have just this open door policy here in our studio.
And once we really transition over to the new studio, there will be room here for dancing. Yeah. All of this tangled wire and everything, this will be gone.
Interesting that it's a tradition. Yeah, thanks for letting us know that, Corey.
It is a tradition there.
I'll embrace this even more then.
And that's why the studio is such a big studio. Today, if you go to a quote-unquote a new built station, the rooms are very small. In fact, if I was to be on the air with you and we would not be in the same studio. We'd be in separate studios between glass looking at each other like you're looking at the producer, like the person reading the weather. That's how it is in all the studios where everybody has their own separate sound studios where that was built to have lots of noise and lots of commotion all in one studio.
Well, maybe we'll bring in video then.
There you go. add a cardboard cutout for that.
Yeah, and stream that. And, we'll be a whole new station. Then meanwhile, MZ's, I think, going around the world with his mom.
Yes, he is. Around the world in 14 days and be back in about another, 3 weeks after having a wonderful time away.
Yeah. Yeah, we got the same brochure. Yeah, it was a two-for-one deal.
Did he go to Hawaii? We thought maybe it was to Europe this time.
No, I think it's around the Mediterranean, then off to Israel. Uh-huh. Anyway, we got 7 seconds left, so I'll say goodbye to you. Have a great show.
Thanks,
enjoy.
Chris.
Thank you.
Sacred Geometry, made for radio.
Right here. KSCO, Santa Cruz.
Time now for What's Next, What's Left, with Dr. Future on AM 1080 KSCO, Santa Cruz.